Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. Donald Trump's visit to the latest addition to his vast property empire at Doonbeg Golf Course and Hotel on Monday generated lots of media interest. The Today Show broadcast live from the newly named Trump International Golf Resort. Sean O'Rourke spoke to the man himself, and at this point in the interview, he asked him what he made of the reception he received at Shannon Airport when he was greeted by the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, at the end of a red carpet laid out on the runway in his honour.
I thought it was an amazing thing that he was there to greet somebody that's putting tremendous amounts, millions and millions and millions, into this country. I thought it was a great thing, not because it's me, but if somebody's investing a lot of money and saving a lot of jobs, because who knows what would have happened here.
But others have already produced thousands of jobs and they didn't get any minister at the bottom of the plane with it. Maybe it was because...
Well, you don't know that. The fact is that I am investing a tremendous amount of money in Ireland. And by the way, we've gotten worldwide publicity. You know, the fact that I came here, look, whether we like it or not, and for some reason, someday you'll explain to me why. I don't even know why, but I get a lot of publicity, disproportional. And this is all over the world that I bought Doonbeg. That's a good thing because it shows that somebody's investing in Ireland. That's not a bad thing. And so for the minister to come here and say hello and thank me, I thought that was a very nice thing. And I'm sure he's done it with other people. But frankly, for the minister to say thank you for saving hundreds of jobs, because I don't know what would have happened with this place if I didn't buy it.
Somebody else would have.
Possibly. And maybe they wouldn't do the job that Trump is going to do.
And last thing, you probably get asked this often. Do all these jokes people make about your hair, do they bother you?
Oh, they kill me. Really? Well, the people kill me. No, it used to bother me years ago, but it never stopped. And it is my hair, as you probably noticed. But I get more comments. I had a story written in a major periodical a couple of weeks ago saying that nobody's doing better than Trump. You know, my company's sure. Very strong and very powerful and doing great all over the world. But they had one sentence, but he has the worst hairpiece I've ever seen. I don't wear a hairpiece. I said, you know, it's a shame. I can't even show this
story. Did Trump, is he fair not to do a big close analysis last year sometime and come to the conclusion?
Oh, Barbara Walters did. She took my hair and analyzed it and the whole thing. And it was.
Yeah, but you're one of the few guys I've ever seen, and maybe it's because you own the place. It probably is. Managed to leave his cap on in a bar, in a golf club.
Oh, I took it off. Oh, yeah. No, I had it off.
Yeah.
Sean O'Rourke talking to Donald Trump about red carpets, hair pieces and hats on Monday's Today Show. On Tuesday's programme, Sean did a follow-up item in which he spoke to two commentators with differing opinions on the way Donald Trump was welcomed to Ireland. First, you'll hear Tim Vaughan, editor of the Irish Examiner, followed by Irish Independent columnist Eamon Delaney.
This was, you know, forelock-tugging of an embarrassing kind, and I haven't seen it for many years. I think it's a retrograde step. We're a very hospitable country. But, you know, you do it with self-respect. You don't do it in the fashion that Michael Noonan was doing yesterday. I think maybe, you know, it was a lapse of judgment on his part. I don't think he'll see it as his finest moment. I can't see why he couldn't have welcomed Donald Trump in the VIP lounge at Shannon. You don't see ministers coming out for any other big jobs announced, greeting their CEOs on the tarmac in Dublin Airport.
Okay, well, let's go to Eamon Delaney. Was that a bit over the top?
Oh, I don't think it was. I think Tim's article, with respect, was completely over the top in The Examiner. He called it pathetic Gombinism of the shabbiest and most insecure kind, that it surpassed anything that was done for Davy Fitzgerald in the return of the Clare Hurlers. I mean, Tim must know that this is just wild hyperbole in describing an event where we have, what, three musicians, a few officials, and the minister, Michael Noonan, standing there. I mean, you would think that we put on a circus of leprechauns and jumping magicians and so
well, I
on.
I think that was all that was missing, actually, with the leprechaun.
Look, the over-the-top bit was the jet that Trump arrived in with his Trump tail fin. That's what he's, as you said, he's showbiz. Go and look at his Wikipedia entry. You take you a week to read it. He's a multifaceted, fascinating, maddening figure in many ways, but he's a very high-profile figure, and that's the way he arrives. I mean, he opens the door and he waves, and it's like a pseudo-president or king. Just let me finish for a minute, because you're just... Like, the point that I made in my own piece is this is tongue-in-cheek, and Michael Noonan was there. He's a clever man. He knows well that this is part of the tongue-in-cheek aspect. It's just a bit of crack. I don't think there's anything undignified. It would be done for many other major investors and many other figures. It was all over in a matter of minutes. And inside, we had the serious speeches that we have at any FDI IDA conference of that kind, which is about job creation and investment.
I have no problem with that, Eamon. The problem is with the way the welcome was done.
Well, what's wrong with him?
Minister Noonan, with all due respect, you say this is showbiz. Michael Noonan is our Minister for Finance, not our Minister for Showbiz.
Politics is showbiz, Tim. You know, that's what it's about. And, you know, it really is.
As we'll see over the next few weeks.
Tim Vaughan and Eamon Delaney, as heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. Garda whistleblowers continue to feature in the news this week. Retired Garda whistleblower John Wilson was Marion Finucane's guest in studio last Saturday. And at this point in the interview, he tells Marion about the time he had a rat tied to his front door.
2 weeks later, in mid-2013, I found a rat tied to my front door.
A rat is fairly significant.
Yes, Marion, I live in a kind of an isolated area, in a rural area. And, you know, rats have specific connotations. And this was kind of very ironic, really, because a police officer kind of reporting corruption, being called a rat, but whatever. A few more little bits and pieces happened, and I came to the conclusion that my position was no longer tenable within the organisation. And as I joined at 19 years of age, I was 50 in April of last year, and I retired on May Day 2013. I left the force.
And what did that mean to you?
Broke my heart, really.
And did your wife never say to you, you know, would you give it a break or, you know, look after your health and look after yourself and look after your family, John? You know, you can't save the world.
Well, had you some kind of a recording device in my house?
She did say that, did she?
Well, yes, she was concerned for my welfare and whatever. But as I stated earlier, I'm a very, very stubborn individual. I will pursue such matters, you know, kind of when I deem something is wrong, I pursue it to the end.
Right. Would you say right now you're regarded as a troublemaker or somebody who did the state some service?
I'd say really a mixed bag. I mean, I'd say there are guards out there who regard myself and Sergeant McCabe as traitors to the organisation. And I'm sure I know there are other guards who are really so glad that we've taken the actions that we have taken, and that we have uncovered these, you know, as Leo Varadkar said, that we have shone a light on these dark places.
Retired Garda whistleblower John Wilson talking to Marion Finucane last Saturday. The Oireachtas Justice Committee hearing on Wednesday heard a number of submissions in relation to Garda oversight. In his report for Drive Time, Barry Lenehan included a contribution made by Dr. Richard O'Flaherty.
Part of my job was to attend Garda stations. What I've seen there is horrific.
Dr. Richard O'Flaherty worked as an on-call doctor for Garda stations and as a member of the Justice for All Victims Support Group. He told the committee of a number of alleged abuses of people in custody.
Another special needs boy was arrested. He borrowed his father's car. He's 17, special need. The body of a 17-year-old, the mind of 8 to 10. He was taken in, stripped of his pants and underpants, whipped with the belt, and told that I'm synopsizing the whole thing for you, and told that they'd arrest his dad also and give him the same thing.
After a debate between committee members over the relevance of Dr. O'Flaherty's submission, the doctor continued and called for all patients in Garda custody to be allowed to their doctor of choice.
All patients be entitled to their doctor of choice when they are in custody. And that that should be a criminal offence for a guard to refuse it, and that he should be reported to the Ombudsman. Second, there should be a protocol put in place to protect my vulnerable people, which I was trying to describe to you. Right? Thirdly, which I think is vital, and it's in England and everywhere else, no statement should be taken without a solicitor being present.
From Wednesday's Drive Time, also on that same programme, we heard from solicitor Paul Conlon, who represented the Roma family in Athlone, who you might remember had their 2.5-year-old son taken away from them by Gardaí last year, arriving from suspicions that the child wasn't a member of their family. In advance of a report into that incident, Paul Conlon spoke to Philip Boucher-Hayes.
The child was taken away from Athlone Garda station in a squad car. To this day, the parents still don't know where the child was taken.
How long was he taken away?
He was taken, they were in the Garda station for about 3.5 hours, so this was around about 10:30 at night. First thing in the morning, my clients called to the local health centre, where they were known by the HSE officials, and explained what had happened. and the HSE officials contacted the Garda Síochána immediately.
And how long was it before they were reunited with Iancu Jr.?
It was in the early afternoon before the child was reunited with the parents. Yeah, I think it's worthy of comment that this family have lived in Athlone for almost 8 years, and they've always lived in the same area. They would be well known in the area. And both Iancu and his older sister Regina were born in Port Yonkla Hospital, Banasloe, which is the local maternity hospital. So even if the Gardaí had checked with the hospital, I'd venture to suggest that they would have got the information from
but
that
you
source.
Really can't help us shed any light, can you, on what motivated the Gardaí, what formed their suspicions or what prompted them to take action?
My clients were told in Athlone Garda Station that their suspicions arose from the fact that Iancu Jr. had blonde hair and blue eyes, and that he had no facial similarities or physical similarities with his parents. The parents were able to produce evidence to the Gardaí at the time that young Iancu suffered from oculocutaneous albinism as an explanation for the blonde hair.
Oculocutaneous meaning of the eye and of the skin, and obviously as well as of his hair.
He's quite defective.
What was the impact emotionally, psychologically on the parents?
It was extremely traumatic. They didn't know what this process was all about. They didn't know where the child was being taken. They didn't know for how long the child was going to be taken away. They honestly didn't know until they were assured by the health service executive officials the following morning that the child would be returned safely.
What was the actions of the Gardaí locally? Did they apologise when they realised the mistake had been made?
No, I'm instructed by my clients that they have, to this day, received no apology from any source whatsoever. And bear in mind that this action was also taken without my clients getting any legal advice when they were in that Athlone Garda Station. And there was no translator made available to them.
Solicitor Paul Conlon talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes on Wednesday's Drive Time. It's 40 years this week since the Dublin Monaghan bombings, and to mark that anniversary, on Sunday with Miriam, we heard from survivors of the bombings. Here, Bernie McNally, who at the age of 16 was working in O'Neill's shoe shop on Talbot Street at the time, recalls that day.
As I was running down the stairs to the basement, and I heard the first bomb going off in Parnell Street, it stopped me in my tracks, and then I continued on into the store, grabbed the sandals and ran up the stairs. And when I got up the stairs, there was flats over the shop. So May McKenna, who was from the north of Ireland, was on strike out of Cleary's. So when she heard the bomb going off, she came down to the ground floor and I came up from the basement. And we met in the hallway between the ladies and gents' shops. And Mr O'Neill was there as well. And she had the big Georgian door open. And he was telling her to close it. And she said to me, "Did you hear a bomb going off?" And I said, "Yeah, I think it was a bomb." And I took maybe two steps away from her and a big flash caught my attention in the sky. And when I looked up, I thought, it's probably lightning, but it was a nanosecond thought because with that, the blast hit me and I was thrown and the ground vibrated and things fell on us and the windows came in. But there was such a loud noise you couldn't hear. It was a deafening noise that you couldn't hear. I got up on my hands and knees and I was trying to find the late night shopper because I was quite close to her as I came into the shop. She was groaning very weakly, but I was only 16. I was saying to her, "Will you groan louder so I can find you?" But now I realise she was dying at the time, but I didn't realise that. And then I couldn't see her. My sight was gone at that stage. And then I eventually got to my feet and was wondering why Mr O'Neill wasn't coming to help me. I couldn't understand because he'd seen me just going in and I thought this had only happened to me. But I got up and eventually the dust, I think, raised and my sight came back that way in my left eye. I went out into the street and there was just silence, just a deafening silence in the street and dust. And people start slowly emerging, a few people start to come along. And a guy from the educational company, he took me down to Moran's Hotel. A lot of the injured were brought down there. But May McKenna was killed. That was a lady that lived in the flat upstairs and the late night shopper. And along with 12 other people, there was 14 people killed in Talbot Street that day.
Bernie McNally talking to Miriam O'Callaghan last Sunday. Another story about a bombing featured in an interview on the John Murray Show on Monday. John spoke to Mark Mulholland about how his younger brother Darren inspired him to write a novel loosely based on his experiences growing up in Dundalk.
He was working for me fine for the office and that, and one day he says he needed the next day off, that he was going to visit a farm which he visited every summertime. And that's fine, he went the next day, that was a Friday. And I just happened to be passing, I was out of the office, and I just happened to be passing a TV shop or something like that, and there was a news report on about bombers being arrested in London. And I just noted it, because it's very unusual that they were caught on the street. People will remember this case because it was the Elaine Moore case in Ireland where there was three boys and a girl arrested. Anyway, I got back to the office, didn't think much about it, and the phone rang. And my parents' neighbour was on the phone to me, and he says that my quiet parents' quiet house was surrounded by armed police and soldiers, and they were going in through the windows.
And this is 1998?
This is 1998, yes. Mm. I couldn't figure out. First, I was thinking, was he involved with drugs? Or I immediately thought it must be Darren. I couldn't imagine my father and my mother, but, you know, they're such good, simple people. So I, it was a mistake, but I knew it wasn't a mistake. I knew this was too dramatic. And I couldn't figure it out. And then the phone rang again, and you know, who I had seen being arrested in London was my brother.
And what was the discussion in the family in the wake of that?
Oh, I think it was total shock. I mean, when something like that happens, and you, there's no experience in the family. My family are not political. You know, they're very, very good people. My brothers and sisters are all, you know, they're very good. They do good things, and they're just normal people. Like nobody had ever been involved in politics, or you know, in the progression of that into the Republican cause. It was never discussed at our thing, apart from what we see on the news.
So suddenly,
it was a shock, and then that took us into a world that none of us had been involved. Of course, then you know, then there's a, you know, the progression of what happens next.
1999, then they came.
Yeah, so
court.
Then he was arrested in London. He was tried in London in the Old Bailey, and he was sentenced to 22 years.
For conspiring to cause an explosion.
Yes, he's still in prison, and the charge was conspiracy to cause explosion. Now I know it's a fairly debatable charge. You know, I've never disputed it.
Just to explain that the bombing, that nobody was actually killed, that they were apprehended.
And look, there's no good in this. There's no good story to give you, except that that's good fortune. In other words, they were very young, the three of them who were arrested at that time. And even when you look at the charge against them and you see the evidence, they were quite naive. I mean, they were never going to be not caught. I mean, it was so innocent, not innocent, of course, in its determination. But it was a very simple plot that they were doing, and they were caught out.
But the fact that they were members of the real IRA, the dissident group, and there had been all of this peace process. Now, they were arrested before OMA happened, but the real IRA was responsible for
absolutely.
OMA.
Absolutely.
Mark Mulholland talking to John Murray on Monday. Roddy Doyle and Roy Keane wouldn't seem like the most obvious of bedfellows, but as we heard on Monday's Today show, the Dublin writer and Cork footballer have teamed up to write the official Roy Keane autobiography. Roddy Doyle told Sean O'Rourke how their collaboration came about.
I got an email, an invitation from a publisher asking me would I be interested in writing a book with Roy Keane. So I gave it some thought as to, you know, did I want to do it? Would I be any good at it? Reasonable questions. That the fact that I wasn't a sports journalist, was that an advantage or not? The fact that I wasn't a Manchester United supporter, could that be an advantage? And, you know, so I gave it some thought, and then I said, you know, yeah, I am interested. But I don't know why my name was thrown into
maybe,
the bucket. Or anything like
maybe
that.
He had seen The Van or read it.
He might have done.
You don't know? You didn't talk to him about that yet?
No.
And how does the relationship work?
We meet very regularly. We go through stuff for about 4-hour sessions, and we go back over things again and again and again. And I think the spark in the book will be in the going back over the things. We go through passages and chapters line by line, and make changes. And so it's very much the two of us working together.
And is it written first person?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it will be in that traditional sense, or in that literal sense, it'll be ghostwritten, insofar as my hope would be that myself as a presence will be non-existent, that I won't be there at all.
And presumably you're going to be getting on as well at the end, or will you be as you were at the start? Have you become friends, in other words?
I enjoy the sessions as much as I'd say. I enjoy them.
Have you come across any good Cork phrases working with them?
There's no such thing as a good Cork phrase. No.
Roddy Doyle talking to Sean O'Rourke on Monday. The announcement this week of the upcoming auction of letters exchanged between Irish priest Father Joseph Leonard and Jackie Onassis received lots of attention everywhere. The Irish Times published excerpts from those letters, and on Tuesday's Today Show, Deputy Editor Dennis Staunton told Sean about the letters and what they reveal about the relationship between John F. Kennedy and the First Lady.
She clearly got his measure the moment that she met him. First of all, she realised that he was an extraordinarily ambitious person. She said she'd never seen such ambition. It's like Macbeth, she said. And she said that she realised that if he were ever to marry her, that it would be for practical reasons, because a senator needs a wife. But that she thought that although, you know, even though when he was off campaigning, she hardly heard from him, that still she realised that he loved her as much as he loved anybody, but just he was preoccupied with his political career. But then she said in one letter, she said, he's like my father in a way. Her father was something of a philanderer, Jack Bouvier, who had left her mother when she was just 7 years old. She said, he's like my father in a way, loves the chase and is bored with the conquest. And once married, he needs proof that he's still attractive, so flirts with other women and resents you. I saw how that nearly killed Mummy. So clearly, Jackie Kennedy, who was in her early 20s, 12 years younger than John F. Kennedy, she knew who she was marrying. The letters started to diminish as she got busier, as she was First Lady. But then, towards the end, after Kennedy's assassination, she wrote two letters to Father Leonard, one in which she described how bitter she was with God and how she said, you know, only he and you and I know that, and that she didn't want her children to know about this bitterness. She didn't want them to grow up feeling angry with God, but she just didn't understand how the assassination could be part of God's plan, really. And she was very religious, but she struggled with her faith throughout the years. And then she said, you know, God, if I ever meet him, God is going to have a bit of explaining to do. And then a few weeks later, she wrote another letter to Father Leonard, where she said, I feel more cruelly every day what I've lost. I always would have rather lost my lone life than to have lost Jack.
Dennis Staunton talking to Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday.
My favourite holiday, I would like to touch a dolphin, make a big splash with my dad.
Now that's taken from the new Discover Ireland ad, and if you're listening to Wednesday's Liveline, you'll have heard it played out a few times when listeners who had been attacked by that same dolphin that is actually used in the ad rang in to talk to Joe. The dolphin is called Dusty, and in recent years he has come to be known as the Doolin Dolphin. Valerie described her encounter with Dustin the Dolphin to Joe.
I was the fourth injury. I mean, the woman before me contacted me after she heard me on your show. And she was very badly injured. She had a perforated gut, and she was hospitalised and apparently nearly died. So, you know, it's serious enough. And then there was the person who was airlifted back to Germany, and somebody prior to that, the first injury in July, Dusty bit this young girl and her father had to jump in to save her. And then there was an injury in September after me where Dusty attacked another woman in the pier. But it's always in the pier. And you know, that's the danger. People, they're naive, they think it's okay to get in, and she's powerful and she gets frustrated and she's prone to attack.
And in your case, Valerie, you were swimming in the pier.
Because there was a woman in the pier at that time. It was about 9 o'clock at night, and it was tickling her. And this is a woman who really knows Dusty and they have a great connection. But I got in thinking it was okay to do so, you know, a false sense of security. You know, if Dusty was being that cuddly and affectionate, it was okay for me to get into the pier. And then that's where I was wrong, because I've heard since she gets very territorial with the people that she's swimming with, the people that she knows, and she doesn't want anybody else coming in disturbing that moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did, and she just attacked me for it.
And she turned on you in an instant, didn't she?
She did. She flipped. I didn't understand what the tail flapping meant, so I kind of hung around too long in the water. I should have got out as soon as she started tail flapping.
And you can see it on YouTube. It's incredible. Yeah. He practically lifts you out of the water and you get very, very frightened.
Yeah.
Valerie, as heard on Wednesday's Liveline. Later in the programme, we also heard from Michelle, who suffered serious injury as a result of her encounter with the same dolphin.
This dolphin shouldn't be in a Discover Ireland ad. He should be on Crime Call. What did he do to you, Michelle?
I was just paddling in the water that day. I was in a wetsuit, but I wasn't going to go in any further. The dolphin wasn't there. Suddenly he appeared, came straight at me and whacked me with its tail. And I managed to climb out of the water. I don't think I was too bad. but the lifeguard turned up then and the Coast Guard, and they said, would I go to hospital? So I did. Apparently I was on a trolley overnight, but I don't remember any of that. But the next day, an X-ray was done and found out the dolphin had perforated my intestines.
Oh, my God. Just with the smack of the flip?
Yes, just with the flick of its tail straight into my stomach, yes. So I was in hospital 2 weeks. I was in intensive care. I was extremely ill.
Oh, my God.
I'm very lucky I'm here. I think I'm here because I had a thick wetsuit on. I don't think I would have been here. My child was in the water with me. If it had been my child, the child wouldn't be here. It's horrific.
And is your perforated intestine recovered?
Pretty much so. I'll never be the same again as I am. And I lost a lot of weight. I'm here and I'm healthy. Okay. And that's obviously the main thing.
From Wednesday's Liveline. Staying with wildlife, albeit of a more gentle nature, the annual Mooney Nest Watch went live this week. And on Wednesday's show, Derek spoke to Eric Dempsey about how this year's blue tits are a bit ahead of themselves, since already a number of chicks have hatched.
It looks like there are still two eggs in there. There's just a big ball of bodies, pink bodies, like the Giro d'Italia has infected them. Anyway, they're little pink hatchlings, would you call them? Nestlings?
Nestlings, yeah. I mean, these chicks at this stage are basically just little, like, prehistoric little dinosaur-type things. There's no feathers on them. They're totally bald. They're blind. And in effect, all they are is one big mouth so that they can get fed, and then they poo. And that's really all they're doing at the moment. And they are helpless. They can't move. They can't walk. They're just simply, you know, almost, they don't have control over their wings, their legs, their necks. And if people are watching at the moment, when an adult will come in, you know, you'll just see the heads going up trying to, you know, get fed, but like they've no control even over their neck movement. So they're not the most attractive looking birds at the moment.
Oh, I'm sure their mammy doesn't agree. Eric Dempsey has heard on Wednesday's Mooney. And you can, of course, view activities in the nest in Derek's back garden live on the Mooney Show website. And while you're at it, check out details of the National Dawn Chorus Day, which takes place through the night and into the dawn this Saturday and Sunday. Dolores Keane featured in a television documentary this week, and she was also John Murray's guest in studio on Monday. She told John about the positive things which have emerged from her recent battle with breast cancer.
I mean, I think there's a reason for everything. And I was kind of singing the same songs, going to the gig, kind of half-heartedly getting on stage and all that. And when I say I needed a root up the arse, I didn't mean it that hard. Mm. But, you know, the way I'm now and the way that I was, I think it did happen for a reason, you know. And when I went into Hope House to give up drink, I just walked through the doors of the place and I was greeted there. And I knew in my heart and soul that I would never drink again. And then, of course, I was 3 weeks there when the cancer was discovered.
How did you feel, by the way, when the diagnosis was confirmed that it was breast cancer? What was your first thought?
I was very positive, you know. I thought, well, right, I have breast cancer. And this can be removed. And I didn't want to think any kind of negative thoughts at all. And haven't done since. It showed me as well kind of how strong a person can be, you know. Whereas before I stopped the drink and all that, everything got to me. Like I'd be hiding in corners and, you know, because I was a drunk, you know, an alcoholic, you know, drinking in the sly and the odd bottle in the bag and wondering, did anyone see me? And now today I can say, yes, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And it's a disease, just the same as the cancer is.
A lot of people would sort of sympathise and say, well, having been landed with the blow of being told you had breast cancer, that might be a good excuse to go back in the jar. Mm. Did you ever feel tempted?
No, none at all. Mm. Well, I think what it was, John, was when I saw the other patients in there with cancer and their stories in Hope House and young kids coming in with daddy to see their mother. And I thought, God Almighty, I've neglected my son and daughter for this long, you know. And it wasn't, I was thinking like, well, it's payback time. What I'll do now is I'll really treat them or something else. But it was a great experience for them to see me deal with all those things. I think they're stronger people for that as well.
Dolores Keane talking to John Murray on Monday. Also on Monday, Arena featured a public interview with filmmaker Ken Loach. In this excerpt, he talks about a commission he received in his early film career, which didn't turn out quite as planned.
After we'd done Kes, I think it was, about 69, 70, we were approached by Save the Children Fund to do a documentary about their work. And at face value, it seemed a very good thing to do. Saving children, what could be wrong with that? So we were guided into some of the work, and we focused on three areas of work. One was a home for children in the south of England, near London, that took kids from poor areas in the north and gave them a holiday. And, yeah, we saw the poor kids being taken, but the people who were giving them the holiday were outrageous. They were talking about their bad manners, the parents who put coal in the bath, literally, and the fact that some of them had no hope. They were the undeserving poor. Children had no table manners, didn't know how to eat their food, would lie, disreputable. I mean, shocking, shocking attitudes. So we showed that. We went to Uganda, and that was pretty good. They were just giving out medicine. And then we went to Nairobi, and the Save the Children Fund was sponsoring a school which was about educating a black middle class from kids who were taken from the slums of Nairobi to educate a middle class that would rule Kenya on behalf of British business. And the way they did that was to develop a consciousness amongst these kids. So the school had a parade ground. They would parade like young soldiers in the morning. They would salute the flag. The library was full of cast-offs from English public schools, like Tom Brown's School Days and schools from somebody of the lower fourth or something, or all about the English posh. There was an American black teacher there who was outraged, who said he'd been disciplined because he'd worn a shirt he bought in the marketplace in Nairobi, and because it was an African shirt, he was disciplined, told he couldn't wear it. And it later we discovered that the headmaster, it was alleged, had shot more Africans in the Mau Mau uprising than anyone else. So we showed this naively in our youth. And the guy came from Save the Children Fund, sat in the viewing theatre, and, like, the steam that came out of his ears was something to behold, was outraged beyond words, and didn't speak as he left. And within hours, the heavies came to the cutting room and took the film away.
Ken Loach talking to Sean Rocks on Monday's Arena. And that film, which he spoke about there, is actually being screened at the IFI in Dublin today as part of a retrospective season on Loach's work. Another filmmaker on air this week was Jim Sheridan. He spoke to Dave Fanning on 2FM on Saturday. Always a good man to tell a story. Here he recalls a run-in which he had with Johnny Rotten during his tenure as chairman of the Project Arts Centre in Dublin in 1979.
I came back from Berlin, and the board had decided they were going to rebuild the project, but they'd taken out everything, toilets, everything. And I was like, how are we going to make... Anyway, I was suddenly sitting there with the project empty, trying to figure out what I do. And I got the kids, Naomi and Teth, Kirsten, and we took white paint down, just repainted the walls. No toilets, no office. Mm. And then I said, what can I do here? Because I was feeling I was responsible because I was the chairman and the worst chairman ever. Nigel came to me and said, why don't we do a punk concert? So we got Public Image and no tickets sold. So some kid came in with a big mohawk head, and I was like, hey, you, come here. Why aren't you buying a ticket? And he said, because they aren't going to turn up. And I was like, what do you mean they're not going to turn up? He said, it's the new intervention. And I was like, what do you mean intervention? And it seemed something I didn't know, that the punk thing was an interventionist art statement from Italy, yeah, that was part right. of a whole social
I'm sure
class.
It was. Yeah.
And that, so I rang Johnny Rotten, and he more or less told me to F off on the phone. So I said, okay. I got on the plane to London, and I flew to there, and I went to Fulham, Gunter Grove, where he lived. And I could hear the music coming out of the house, and I went up and I pressed a buzzer, and his brother answered the door. I think it was his brother. He said, what, you want to see John? I said, yeah, I want to find if he's coming to Ireland, but I just want him to tell me to his me face that he's not coming after they committed to come. And your man was like, yeah, I'm here. And he went to shut the door, and I kicked it open, and all the Public Image came down the stairs and hammered me up and down Gunter Grove. and got me on a car. And then I just flipped and I just got up and I just went up to John's face and I just like that, just stood right beside him. And I followed him for a while and the press start reporting it. We took them off. It was the biggest lesson of my life. And we put U2 in instead and we sold all the tickets in like 24 hours.
Yeah, but hold on a second. You didn't sell the tickets necessarily because it was U2. It was because it was getting there. Do you know how I know?
No,
because U2 went on at 2 o'clock in the morning in a room right beside it. You were showing a movie called Death Race 2000 and I was one of I was one of 6 people watching U2 as 50 people or 100 people were watching the movie inside because I reviewed that for Hot Press.
See, in my mind,
3 in the morning.
In my little head, I thought U2 made a huge difference. Probably not.
Jim Sheridan talking to Dave Fanning on 2FM last Saturday. Last week's lyric feature, Are We Dancing?, heard the story of sisters Beatrice and Elizabeth West, who are members of Cushcame Dance Theatre's Broadreach class for the over 55s. The sisters told Regan Hutchins about their love of dance.
Well, we did go to another organisation called the League of Health and Beauty. Beauty is important.
Have you ever heard of it? No.
It's not called that now.
No, it's called the Fitness League. So it was into sort of more movement, not so much rigid exercises that perhaps you might have learned when you were younger. It was more flowing, using more arm movements and, of course, footwork as well.
I don't think it really matters at what age you take up dancing. You don't have to start when you're young. You can pick it up.
Sometimes you feel your body does kind of, as you get older, like it's not as free as it used to be, and you can feel it sometimes, but you forget about that.
Elizabeth, I was taking notice of you when I visited the dance class because when your team was told to take a break, you hoisted yourself up on a table with an agility that I envied.
You don't know what I was going through.
Do you foresee a time when your mobility will decrease and when dancing becomes more difficult?
No, I don't think so. I think I'll always be able to. I'm not picturing myself not being able to move. I'm looking forward to going back to the dancing. I can't see myself not being able to dance. I'm not going to think that way.
Ah, yes, the power of positive thinking and dance. From Regan Hutchins' Are We Dancing?, which was last week's lyric feature. The book on one this week was a real treat. It featured author Donal Ryan reading from The Spinning Heart, the novel which won him the 2013 Guardian First Book Award. This is from the opening reading in which Bobby McMahon, the central character in the book, visits the father of the now bust builder he's been working for.
Pokey Burke left his father and mother to mop up after him. The owl lad said he didn't know where Pokey was, but I knew he was lying. He owes me money, Josie, I said. Does he now? Did he not pay you a fine wage? He was looking down at me from the third step before his front door. I might as well have had a cap in my hand and called him sir. My stamp, my pension, my redundancy. I could hear my own voice shaking. The state looks after all that when fellas goes bust, he said. Go in as far as town to the dole office. He said no more, only kept looking down at me, down along his nose. Right so I will. I didn't say I'd been there already. We all had. And it turned out Pokey had rowed us up the creek and left us there. I should have said I'd been on to the taxman and the welfare inspectors and the unions and they'd soon soften Pokey's cough. But I hadn't and I didn't. And I turned away with a pain in my heart for the man I'd thought I was.
Donal Ryan reading from his book The Spinning Heart on this week's Book on One. Another author heard on the airwaves this week was Joe O'Connor, who came into the Today studio on Wednesday to talk about his new book, The Thrill of It All. In this excerpt, he talks about gigging with his musical sibling, Sinead.
I think I was the first person at the age of 13 who ever accompanied Sinead in a public performance, which was a talent competition in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary in about 1976. And Sinead was, I think, 10, and she wanted to enter and sing the Kenny Rogers song, Lucille, which has three guitar chords, and I definitely knew two of them. So I was selected, and even my awful guitar playing couldn't prevent her from winning. The prize, I remember, was a jigsaw of the B&I ferry that used to go to Holyhead with several of the pieces missing. And Sinead later, as you know, won, you know, 8 or 9 Grammys for Nothing Compares to You. But on the day itself, I think nothing compared to the jigsaw.
Joe also told Sean about the time he got to meet his hero, Patti Smith.
We all have our idols, and Patti was one of mine. I remember the day of my 13th birthday, an aunt who lived in London had sent me £10 as a gift. And being in a little record shop on the North Keys of the Liffey in Dublin called Freebird Records. It was down in a basement and kind of a furtive place, and just going through the racks of secondhand punk rock records and seeing the cover of Patti Smith's album Horses and buying that record and bringing it home and being absolutely transfixed by the sound of her voice and the passion and the commitment and the attack with which she sang. So I loved her. I bought all of her records and her books and her poetry and followed everything she did, and she appears as a character in The Thrill of It All. But it culminated in a very happy experience. I think 3 or 4 years ago now, myself and Anne-Marie and our boys were living in New York. I was teaching in a college there for a year, and we went along one night to see Patti perform, and she was great. And at the time I was writing a weekly column for the Sunday Independent here in Dublin. And I reviewed the gig as my column that week. And on the Monday morning, I came into work at the college, and there was an email from, I think it might have been from the late Angus Fanning, God be good to him, but from, or Willie Keeley, one of the guys in the Sunday Indo anyway, saying, we have an email here from Patti Smith saying she read your review and she wants to get in touch. So I was convinced this is a mate.
You wouldn't have put that in one of your novels, would you?
I wouldn't, no. So I very cautiously replied, and the email came back, you know, thanks very much for that lovely review. And she said, next time I'm in Dublin, we must have a cup of tea. So I email back and say, well, I'm actually in New York now. I'm teaching 10 minutes away from where you live. So she said, come round to the house. So the day before Christmas Eve that year, I walked up to the door of this house in downtown Manhattan and knocked on the door. And I swear, until the moment it opened, I was convinced that it was going to be somebody else.
Somebody was setting you up.
So she opened the door and she stepped out into the porch. And without saying a word, she put her arms around me. And it was just a fantastic day.
Joe O'Connor talking to Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. And fans of Joe's Drive Time Diaries would be glad to hear that he'd be back on air with a selection of summer diaries from next Wednesday. Fans of country music's newest heartthrob, Nathan Carter, must have been glued to Mooney on Thursday when Nathan featured in a special Mooney Tunes house party hosted by the Cox family in Ballymahon, County Longford. Brenda Dunhu was there when he arrived on a motorbike.
Nathan is on his way. There he is. Okay, we need to clear the path for him. He's coming in the bike, okay? Okay, come in. Move out of the way. Careful, careful. Careful.
Okay. Nathan has just arrived in the driveway on a motorbike. And the crowd are all out cheering him. Nathan Carter, I'm Brenda Dunhu. You are welcome, and thank you for doing the Mooney Tunes house party for
us. No problem, Brenda.
Just getting your helmet off there. This lady, Brona, has won this concert for all her friends and family. So she'd like to say something to you, Nathan.
Thank you for coming. I'm really glad you're here.
Oh, not at all. It's absolutely great to be here, and I've heard a lot about you, and I'm looking forward to the gig tonight. It's going to be good fun.
And as you can see, Nathan, if you turn around, we have all the friends and family here from Ballymahon.
Now that's what you call an entrance. It's time for me to make an exit. I hope you've enjoyed my selection of playback over the last few months. There's no playback next week to make way for election coverage. And Marion Richardson will be back in this chair the week after next. Stay tuned for Richard Curran, who's coming up next on The Business. To play us out, here's more from Nathan Carter's house party on Mooney on Thursday. This is Caledonia. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until the next time, goodbye.
I don't know if you can see the changes that have come over me. In these last 2 days, I've been afraid that I might drift away. As I've been telling old stories and singing songs that make me think about where I came from. That's the reason why I seem so far away today. Sing along, you know. So let me tell you that I love you. I think about you all the time. But Caledonia, you'll call to me. Now I'm going home. And if I should become a stranger, you know it'd make me more than sad. This Caledonia's been everything I've ever had. Have moved, but I've kept on moving. I prove the points that I need to prove, and I've lost the friends that I needed losing, and found others on the way. But I've kissed the girls and I've left them crying. I've stolen dreams, yes, there's no denying. I've had traveled hard, but the conscience flies. Summer in the wind. So let me tell you that I love you, and I think about you all the time. Caledonia, you're calling me. Now I'm going home. And if I should become a stranger, you know it'll make me more than sad. This Caledonia's been everything I've ever.